Welcome to the Sydney Hems podcast. These podcasts are aimed at new members of our retrieval team, but anybody else is welcome to listen in. This is Cliff Reed. Today we're going to talk about neuroprotection. We'll start with a case, and we'll discuss some of the aspects of retrieval that aim at minimizing secondary brain injury. So here's the case. You're on a road retrieval mission from a community hospital emergency department to a teaching hospital centre. You've been called to a 34-year-old male who's had sudden collapse with a grade 4 subarachnoid hemorrhage. He's intubated and ventilated. He is hypertensive at 190 on 115 and is on a propofol infusion. His heart rate is 98. One of his pupils is sluggishly reactive. There's some hydrocephalus on his CT scan. His blood sugar level is 14 millimoles per litre, and his temperature is 37.6. So what are the issues here? He's got a grade 4 subarachnoid hemorrhage. What does that mean? It's important to remember that there are several classification systems. There's the Hunt and Hess system and the World Federation of Neurosurgeons classification. They're clinical scoring systems. And there's the Fisher grade, which is a CT scan scoring system. Rather than remember them all individually, it's just worth reminding ourselves that low grades are less severe, high grades are bad. The clinical systems go from 1 to 5, and the Fisher CT scanning classification system goes from 1 to 4. So whatever system the referring doctor's talking about, grade 4 usually means bad. How are we going to optimize this patient for retrieval? How do we minimize secondary brain injury? I want us first of all to think about what a brain cell, what a neuron needs to function happily. And then we'll think about how we can provide that for this patient. Following that, we'll talk more generally about the neuroprotection helicopter operating procedure, and I'll take you through it. You can download that document from sydneyhems.com and go to resources, then policies and procedures. Okay, you're a brain cell. You want to function happily. What do you need? Well, if you think about it, you need a supply of oxygen that needs to come in blood at an adequate pressure. That blood needs to be able to get there unimpeded by high intracranial pressure. You need adequate cerebral blood flow, which is regulated partly by your PCO2. The blood needs to contain sufficient hemoglobin and oxygen and metabolic substrate, namely glucose. You want to minimize metabolic demands on yourself as this busy brain cell by not being too hot, not having a seizure, and not having to deal with pain, agitation, dyssynchrony with a ventilator through increased work of breathing, for example. And for that blood and that metabolic substrate and oxygen to get to us, we've mentioned we don't want to be competing in a high intracranial pressure environment. And so we want to avoid big shifts in osmolality, namely sodium and glucose. So just to summarize that, we need adequate oxygen and hemoglobin. We need the correct PCO2. We need a decent mean arterial pressure. We need normoglycemia and normothermia. We need seizures to be controlled. We need intracranial pressure to be minimized, which might involve draining hydrocephalus, having an adequate sodium, avoiding big shifts in sodium and glucose. We need to get seizures under control, minimize pain and agitation, and patient ventilated dyssynchrony. We need to allow adequate venous drainage from the head. So if we think about an ABCDE approach, because that's always fun, with airway, let's make sure the tube's not tied too tightly with traditional ties, there's not a tight-fitting collar on for whatever reason. With breathing, we've got adequate ventilation, good oxygenation, but not hyper-oxygenating a patient, and adequate CO2. We need a decent mean arterial pressure and hemoglobin. Head-up positioning is good, make sure the patient's not seizing. Draining hydrocephalus if that's possible, and optimizing sodium, bringing a high temperature under control and making sure the glucose is normal. And some of this information we get clinically, and some of it we can get from a blood gas. So one of the first things we do is ask for an arterial blood gas on these patients. We can check the PO2, the PCO2, and usually the glucose and the sodium on that one rapid bedside investigation. So clinical exam, we need good vital signs, we need to sit them up, we need to check the temperature, bring that down, and get the blood gas, because that gives us the CO2, the glucose, and the sodium, as well as the PO2. So we get to this patient in the community hospital, and I'll describe him again. He's a young man with sudden collapse. He's got a big subarachnoid hemorrhage on his CT. He is intubated and ventilated. He's hypertensive, 190 and 115, and on a propofol infusion. His heart rate's 98. He's got a sluggishly reactive pupil on one side. There's some hydrocephalus on his CT scan. Blood sugar is 14. Temperature is 37.6. Okay, what do you think the first thing you're going to do when you get hands-on with this guy is? Well, we're all worried about that blood pressure, and it's very confusing to work out when you should be actively lowering blood pressure in patients with unsecured subarachnoid hemorrhage. However, that's less of an issue if we pay attention to his basic post-intubation anesthesia needs. He's only on a propofol infusion. He's not getting analgesia. He has the noxious stimulus of a tube in his trachea and being on a mechanical ventilator. So at the very least, we should, as soon as possible, start some opioid on this patient. Giving him fentanyl is what we would recommend. We can keep him on the propofol, but let's give some opioid. Invariably, we find in these patients, when that's started, the blood pressure comes under control, and you're no longer faced with this conundrum about whether or not and how to treat the hypertension. And we really do see this all the time. Many EDs that we visit have patients on ventilators only receiving sedatives without analgesics. And we've got to make sure we remember to add that opioid. So that's going to make him more comfortable. There's going to be less chance of patient ventilator dyssynchrony. The blood pressure and heart rate are going to be reduced. Less noxious stimulus. It's got to be a good thing. All right, we've got obvious raised intracranial pressure from the underlying pathology, the CT appearance, the presence of hydrocephalus, the dropped conscious level, and the appearance of the pupils. What do we do about this? Well, his temperature is 37.6, so we could try to cool him to normothermia. We could do that with neuromuscular blockade, and if necessarily some ice. We look at his sodium, and in this case, with adequate sedation, analgesia, bringing the PCO2 to low normal range on his blood gas, if his pupil still hasn't responded to that, then we would consider some osmotic agent such as mannitol or hypertonic saline. We carry 7.5% hypertonic saline, and we would give him that. We'd have him 30 degrees head up on the stretcher. We might consider bringing that blood sugar down, but it's only 14. We don't want to risk hypoglycemia, and the transport time is relatively short. So in view of the relative urgency of getting him to a neurosurgeon that can place an external ventricular drain to treat the hydrocephalus, most of us would elect to ignore that mild hyperglycemia. But certainly treating the temperature, optimizing position, giving hypertonic saline. If his pupils are still sluggish, despite adequate opioid analgesia and normocapnic ventilation. All right, let's have a look at the neuroprotection helicopter operating procedure, HOP or HOP. We have many of those available to us to guide our therapy and protect us and to protect our patients. So, the overview in the neuroprotection HOP refers to the fact that our primary role here is prevention of secondary injury and avoiding further physiological insults. This applies both to pre-hospital traumatic brain injury management and the inter-hospital retrieval of neurocritical care patients. And the kind of patients that we are asked to transfer include those with traumatic intracranial bleeding or traumatic brain injury, spontaneous parenchymal intracranial hemorrhage, subarachnoid hemorrhage, going for neurocritical care or surgery or endoluminal coiling of their aneurysm, and acute hydrocephalus requiring ventricular drainage. So at the time of the tasking, it's essential to assess the urgency of the transfer that might influence whom we send on the retrieval. Rather than call in an on-call doctor from home, we may elect to send the road or helicopter doctor from the base as they are immediately available. Now, if the patient's being transferred for the management of aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, we should think about their subsequent needs in terms of specialist interventions and avoid future second or third transfers. That's because some centers offer neurosurgery but not neurointerventional radiology. So we want to try and get the patient to the right center straight away. Now, patients requiring urgent surgical management of intracranial hemorrhage, particularly patients with extradural hematomas or sometimes acute subdural hematomas, because we know they benefit from early neurosurgical evacuation, we have to really get those things happening as soon as we can. And if we are more than 2 hours away from a neurosurgeon and the patient fits the description of a talk and deteriorate patient, say they were conscious and then they lost their conscious level, and they have anisochoria, so they've blown a pupil, and we know where the lesion is on our CT scan, then that's the kind of relatively rare patient in whom it may be appropriate to evacuate their hematoma on site, which can either be done by a local surgeon or, if necessary, by the retrieval physician. Now, we cover how to do this in our induction course, but we need to locate the appropriate surgical equipment at the referring hospital because we don't carry it. We recommend a Hudson brace, which is a kind of hand drill. So, to cover that again, patients in whom it might be appropriate for the retrieval physician or local surgeon to evacuate a hematoma, particularly extradural, are those that were awake initially after their injury. So, in other words, they have minimal primary brain injury. They then deteriorated with a drop in conscious level and anisochoria, unequal pupils. And you're more than 2 hours away from a neurosurgeon. Those are patients who have been shown in the literature from other parts of the world to benefit from that intervention, and we should be able to offer that. But we would recommend consultation with a receiving hospital neurosurgeon before embarking on the procedure. The next bit on the neuroprotection operating procedure mentions sedation and paralysis. And in order to avoid spikes in ICP, it's imperative that the patient be adequately analgesed and sedated, because movement between stretchers and changing ventilation circuitry are events that can cause patients to cough, gag, unless they're very well sedated. So the ideal sedation regimen includes adequate analgesia. And fentanyl is an effective analgesic with some sedative properties and is relatively cardiovascularly stable. Propofol is rapidly titratable, reduces cerebral metabolism, and allows for neurologic assessment shortly after weaning. Obviously, it can cause some cardiovascular depression. We should consider the use of paralytic agents for all patients with raised ICP, but obviously only following adequate analgesia and sedation. They can, of course, mask signs of seizure activity, but they are effective in preventing coughing and gagging and patient ventilator asynchrony, and so can protect against those things that contribute to raised ICP. The blood pressure manipulation side of things, as I said before, can get confusing and difficult to remember. We have to consider that cerebral autoregulation in the injured brain can be impaired, and a target cerebral perfusion pressure of 50 to 70 millimeters of mercury is recommended. But we're not normally measuring ICP because most of these patients do not have an EVD in place. So we can't directly determine cerebral perfusion pressure. So we've really got to pick an empirical blood pressure target and aim for that. In pre-hospital traumatic brain injury, we try to maintain the systolic blood pressure at least 90 millimeters of mercury. In the case of unclipped aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, we've got to balance the risk of re-bleeding in the first 24 hours, which is between 7 and 17%, against that of subsequent cerebral vasospasm and its consequent ischemia. But that tends to peak several days later. And hypertension is commonly present at the time of presentation with subarachnoid hemorrhage. And the evidence is really weak, but consensus guidelines support targeting a systolic blood pressure initially in an unclipped aneurysm no higher than 160 millimeters of mercury. Of course, once they've had surgical management or endoluminal coiling procedures, the emphasis shifts to maintaining cerebral perfusion, and there's a more permissive upper limit of blood pressure appropriate for that patient, just like with other forms of stroke. And remember, if we do feel we have to control the blood pressure, optimizing analgesia and sedation is our first line and is almost always successful. Otherwise, you have the option of beta blockade or hydralazine or calcium antagonist, depending on what's available to you, what's preferred by the receiving neurosurgeons, and how expeditiously you have to make this decision. If the patient has spontaneous intracranial hemorrhage, like a big intraparenchymal bleed, there's once again, limited evidence for the role and targets for blood pressure management. Some guidelines suggest controlling the blood pressure when systolic is greater than 200 or the MAP is greater than 150. If they have intracranial hemorrhage and are on anticoagulants, we need to reverse this. If they're on warfarin, we would give prothrombin complex concentrate with vitamin K. Let's consider patients with external ventricular drains. We very rarely encounter these patients, and there's an obvious reason for that. They are put in by neurosurgeons in the neurosurgical centers, and normally we're taking patients to these guys, not from these guys. But as I mentioned before, some centers do not offer the full range of neurosurgery and neurointerventional radiology. So it may well be they have been under the care of neurosurgeons, have an EVD in place, but our team is now transferring them to another neurocenter for interventional radiology. Now, many retrieval doctors do not have previous experience of managing EVDs, so we'll go over it very briefly and very simply for you. But at the end of the day, don't get stressed about this, because we're going to encounter the referring neurosurgeons when we pick up the patients, so we can get their guidance on how they want the EVD to be managed. But remember, these are devices that go into the ventricle and allow measurement of intracranial pressure, and they allow CSF drainage. So they allow management of intracranial pressure as well as monitoring of it. That can be useful for us. So we do discuss the need for ongoing monitoring and intermittent versus constant CSF drainage and preferred drainage height with the referring doctors. There are some pitfalls with these devices. If you clamp them for transfer and forget about them, you can get unrecognized rises in ICP. The EVD's reference point, the zero point, is usually at the level of the tragus of the ear. Sometimes that can be difficult to maintain when you're moving the patient and the equipment. And sometimes the G-forces involved in retrieval, either by road or air, can result in over-drainage from the device, which can lead to further hemorrhage. So there are two main management strategies using the EVD. One is to keep it open throughout the entire retrieval, except during the immediate patient transfers from bed to stretcher, stretcher to receiving bed. Or the other strategy is to leave it closed, but just intermittently open it every few minutes to allow it to drain. And in a very rough journey, or when there's severe turbulence, when there's significant acceleration, deceleration forces, that's probably the preferred option. So we make sure the zero point's ascertained level with the tragus, and the drainage chamber is secured to the retrieval bridge. We clamp that drain when we're sliding and loading patients and at takeoff and landing. We never flush it. That can increase ICP, and that's not our role. Just a little bit on seizure management. Prophylactic phenytoin can be useful in some patients, but isn't routinely recommended after traumatic brain injury unless the patient's already had a seizure. And after intracranial hemorrhage, subarachnoid hemorrhage, it's also controversial. If they've had a seizure or you think they're at high risk, then consider prophylactic phenytoin, but we do not routinely give it. If we see active seizures, then we manage them through the routine measures of intravenous benzodiazepine therapy and correcting reversible causes like hypoglycemia, hyponatremia, hypoxia. Last few points. Intravenous nimodipine is not really a necessary component of the retrieval management. So enteral nimodipine, commenced within 48 hours of subarachnoid hemorrhage, should reduce the chance of delayed cerebral vasospasm. And we've said that's maximal a few days down the line, between day 4 and day 10. So there's no proven role for IV nimodipine in the early stages during resuscitation, stabilization, and transfer. So it's not a necessary infusion to have running. And it reminds us in the helicopter operating procedure that there is no role for the routine use of steroids in either traumatic brain injury or subarachnoid hemorrhage. Just finally, please remember when you're documenting your observations to assess the pupillary responses. There is no role in retrieval of taping the eyes closed in patients with neurosurgical or neurocritical care presentations. We must be regularly monitoring those pupils and being prepared to optimize ventilation and osmotic therapy if they develop anisocoria or delayed pupillary responses. So please do not tape the eyes. This is critical care medicine. This is not routine anesthesia. Okay, that's it. So we have covered a patient with subarachnoid hemorrhage and thought about the classification systems, the basic requirements of a brain cell and how we provide the metabolic substrate, the oxygen, the blood. We minimize ICP through various strategies. We do an ABCDE assessment. We check the position of the patient, the temperature, the glucose, the sodium. We treat seizures. We've discussed the management of external ventricular drains in retrieval, and those rare occasions when we might encounter a patient that has one in. Take-home messages really need to be adequate analgesia and sedation, in particular adding those opioids early because they are frequently forgotten by the referring emergency teams. If in doubt, discuss with the senior retrieval consultant on to get advice and help, and enjoy your time with these important and often very sick patients. That's it for this podcast. Come back soon for more. Thanks for listening. Cheers.